Hello, everybody. Welcome to this edition of Crossfade. Actually, this is the first edition of Crossfade, and maybe even the only edition of Crossfade. We'll just have to see how it goes. I'm your host, Roger Feigelson, and for the next hour, we'll be listening to film music from films both old and new, playing music that you probably weren't aware you never even noticed. That was music by Frederick Talgorn from Asterix. Actually, the film has a longer title than that, but it's all in French, and I don't speak French, and I don't want to butcher the language out of respect for the French language. So we'll leave it at Asterix, if I've even got that pronounced right. And we heard the first track on that album. And now, here's music by Michael Giacchino from the new Star Trek film. This is Enterprising Young Men. Thank you. That was Michael Giacchino's music from the new Star Trek film. That was Enterprising Young Men. And now I've got something completely more obscure than that, although the composer is certainly not obscure. Here are three themes by John Williams that most people probably didn't know were John Williams, probably didn't even notice the music at all. The film was not a huge success. But anyway, they were just released recently, so they were being heard for the first time outside of the film. Here they are.
Thank you.
So you were probably wondering, what were those obscure John Williams themes? And I'm glad you asked. They're from Superman 4, dating from 1987. We heard Nuclear Man theme, Someone Like You, and Jeremy's theme. The music was arranged and conducted by Alexander Courage, who wrote the rest of the score to Superman 4. John Williams couldn't do the entire project due to other commitments, but he did have time to write those three themes. And until recently, that music was not available anywhere until Film Score Monthly released a Blue Box multi-disc set a couple years ago featuring the complete scores to all four Superman films, including the premiere release of Superman 4, in addition to a CD of music from one of the animated series that featured John Williams' theme. So, changing gears completely, reflecting upon film music in recent years, it seems to have become less, and what's the right word here, artful, I guess you could say. And there's a number of factors why that is. Schedules have become compressed, giving composers very little time to write a score, very little time for them to really tap into their creativity. Music editors will put temp tracks onto the film to give audiences and the movie makers an idea of what the film will be like with music, and it also guides the composer to tell them what type of music they should write and how it should sound. And sometimes the filmmakers may fall in love with the temp track and really tie the hands of the composer and make them really emulate the temp track. So that obviously takes a lot of creativity out of that. And many filmmakers are just plain worried that the music will become too overbearing, or themes will crowd the film or sound old-fashioned, and really just dial down the music and ask for something not obtrusive, and it can become just wallpaper. You end up with action films that just have loud thundering scores where all the musicians are just blowing away. There's no theme. It just all runs together. Or you have what I call the Samuel Barber's Adagio for String style, a piece of music which in and of itself has been used in several films, including replacing most of the George de la Rue score to Platoon. And that's where you get these adagio-like scores with the strained strings, and sometimes they'll throw in a piano line that's very melancholy and moody, and they all blend together and become very interchangeable. But there are exceptions. There are opportunities for some real composers out there to rise up above this environment that they're forced to compose in, and can bring a level of art back into film scoring. And I've got a great example here. I'm playing a very lengthy piece of music from this film, and you're going to hear this motif throughout. It's a very simple figure. Many times it's really three chords. I'm dumbing it down a little bit to three notes, although you'll hear a three-note version. But the key is you'll recognize this once you hear the piece and hear how he evolves it and plays with it throughout the piece of music. This is the motif. And I'll play it one more time. Sometimes he'll turn it into a rhythm, like this. In fact, he then has bass trombone pounding out that same musical figure above the rhythm, something like this. And there's no way around it, the piano is just a poor substitute for the bass trombone. But you'll hear this in the strings, you'll hear this in the piano, you'll hear it in a harmonica, you'll hear it all over the place in various guises and shapes. And at the end of what really is a dark journey throughout this piece of music, the composer takes the motif and opens it up into a beautiful, warm theme, proving that traditional composers that have a free rein to explore their creativity and do something artful are still lurking out there in the film world. That was music by Frederick Talgorn from Red Needles. We heard... Ah, oh, darn, it's in French also. Okay, we heard tracks 2 and 3, but not in that order. We heard track 3 first, and then we heard track 2. We should just move along. Here's Jerry Goldsmith's music from Capricorn One. That was the main title to Capricorn One, music by Jerry Goldsmith, and that was actually one of the first soundtracks I owned, so it's partly responsible for me being where I am today. Now, soundtrack collectors have what they call holy grails, and that's, of course, with a small h and a small g. They watch a movie, they love the score, they go to the store to find it, and it's not available. Very common in the 80s and earlier. And these releases become a holy grail to them because they can't get it, but they really want it. I remember in 1981 going into Tower Records and asking for the soundtrack to Arthur B. Rubinstein's score to On the Right Track, and the employee said, oh, it'll be in next Tuesday. Of course, I came in next Tuesday and there was nothing there, and I went the next Tuesday after that and there was nothing there, and there is no album to On the Right Track, and there never was one. It took me years to realize that the Tower Records employee was basically assumed because I was asking for it, it must exist, and therefore it would come in on Tuesday when their new releases would come in. But nonetheless, it's a holy grail, which still remains on my list to this day. For many years, the Jerry Goldsmith score to Night Crossing was my number one holy grail. It's a Walt Disney film about a family who lives in East Germany, and they build a hot air balloon to escape to freedom in West Germany. And in 1987, which is only 5 years after the film came out, which is actually not a bad wait for a holy grail, Doug Fake at Entrada struck a deal with Walt Disney to release the soundtrack to the Goldsmith score. And while sitting in the booth with Goldsmith assembling the album, Goldsmith declared that he wanted the main title left off the album. And so Doug put up a big fight and said, how can we possibly leave the main title off the album? You can't leave the main title off an album. But Goldsmith was very adamant that if they wanted the main title to Night Crossing, they would need to purchase the Capricorn One album. And there are similarities. Capricorn One, as you heard, is a very driving piece of music. It represents the relentless, corrupt government agency that is chasing these astronauts who could leak the story about a faked mission to Mars. Whereas in Night Crossing, that driving rhythm represents the East German government that would really rather kill this family then let them escape to West Germany. Fortunately, Doug prevailed and convinced Goldsmith to put the main title on the album under the condition that all the dramas from the prologue were cut down extensively. And they were for the first release, but for a subsequent expanded edition, the prologue was restored, which is a good thing because here you can see a careful architecture at work as he starts with some very low percussion and slowly builds upon the percussion as it leads up to the main title. It gives some structure that you wouldn't otherwise have. They can buy Capricorn One. Come on, Jerry. Thank you. So the question is, did the family successfully make it into West Germany? The music is a little ambiguous on that point. We heard prologue, main title, and In the West, music composed and conducted by Jerry Goldsmith with the National Philharmonic Orchestra. Next up is a piece of music from a film just a couple of years ago, and in fact the composer here is doing something very similar to what Goldsmith was doing in his prologue to Night Crossing, and that is taking an idea and repeating it and slowly building upon it as it works up to a very powerful climax. The film is a great sci-fi tale of the last city on Earth, established deep within the planet, after some sort of apocalypse on the surface. But the infrastructure of this centuries-old city is failing, making this last outpost of human civilization a mere fading ember. That was music by Andrew Lockington from City of Ember. We heard the City of Ember main titles and One Last Message. Now I'm going to switch gears completely here. About 20 years ago, a very good friend, Mark Newton, passed away way too prematurely. And at his funeral, his brother talked about how much Mark loved James Horner's adaptation of Amazing Grace that appeared in Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. And he wanted to play it at the service, but he couldn't because the album that was available at the time did not include that piece of music. Now, fortunately, Film Score Monthly just last year released a complete and expanded edition, which did include that piece. Now, this appears in the film during Spock's funeral. And now, Mark, I'm going to assume that it is the orchestral part of this cue that had such meaning to you, not the bagpipe intro, for in the film, the sequence opens with Scotty playing Amazing Grace on the bagpipes, and even James Horner commented that it sounded like bleeding goats, and he was actually against the whole idea of using Amazing Grace to begin with, but because you're Mark, and because this piece had such meaning to you, and you didn't get to be played in honor of you at your own service, I'm going to play it for you now, and after that I'm going to play something completely incongruous, Trevor Jones' end title to Nathan Hayes. Thank you. We heard two things there. We heard Amazing Grace from Star Trek II by James Horner. Well, James Horner didn't write Amazing Grace, but that was his adaptation. And then we heard the end title from Nate and Hayes, music by Trevor Jones. And with that, we're out of time, but I'm going to leave you with a little more Frederick Talgorn and his music from Asterix.